Good morning, universe, and welcome to another day, redeemed from death and looking forward to life because of what our Lord Jesus Christ has done for us. You're listening to Sharper Iron, waking you up every morning with the law and gospel of the living God, drawn straight from the text of Holy Scripture for you, all a part of your morning drive for the soul here on Worldwide KFUO. Christ for you, anytime, anywhere. I'm your host, Pastor Jonathan Fisk, administrative pastor at St. Paul Lutheran Church in Rockford, Illinois. And on this Wednesday, the 16th, man, I feel like I'm time traveling. I feel like yesterday was the 16th. I must be wrong. Today's Wednesday? Thursday. That's part of the issue. It is Thursday, the 16th of May. We're going to be looking at Genesis chapter 25, verses 25 through 34, finishing up what was begun yesterday with this introductory conflict between Jacob and his brother Esau, deceiver or heel grabber, and his brother Red Guy, and that connection that they have as children of Isaac to the promise of the messianic seed, the line from which Christ will come, and the prophecy given to their mother that it won't come through the one that you would expect it to come through. To help us work our way through this text, the selling of the birthright by Esau to Jacob, we have with us Pastor David Appold. He is pastor at St. Paul Lutheran Church in Paducah, Kentucky. I was really fascinated, Pastor Appold, looking through your notes. As you talked about context, I liked a lot of what I saw there. I don't know how else to introduce the question other than just say that again. What about the context of the story do we need to know to really gather the fullness of what's going to go on in this little bit about the porridge?
Sure. I think seeing kind of the forest, and then we'll get to the trees, right? I'm sure you've used that analogy before. But what does this story have to do, or how does this part of the Genesis account relate to what came before it, I think is a helpful thing, because when we come to Jacob and Esau, we're hearing something we've heard a little bit before, but in a slight variation. So if we can think back, and our hearers, you know, if this is your first time listening, if you haven't been listening into the Genesis thing, that's okay. I mean, these are well-known stories. You'll remember Abraham gets this promise from God, right, that he's going to have descendants as numerous as the sand on the seashores and as numerous as the stars in the heavens, and that especially through one particular offspring, God's blessing is going to come into the whole world, right? And so Abraham says, great, this is awesome. But then God doesn't give him what he said he's going to give him, at least not right away. And so you have this Abraham. At the time, he's still Abram. He and his wife, Sarah, come up with this plan. You know, well, we're supposed to have a descendant, but we're both barren, or one of us is barren. You know, it's not working. Let's have, Sarah says, why don't you take Hagar as your wife? And, you know, then the descendant will come through Hagar. And so they have Ishmael. And God comes to Abram and says, that's not the plan, buddy. And so he says, it's going to be through Sarah. And so then you have the birth of Isaac. And so you get this whole thing. Well, which son was it? Which was Isaac the son of promise, or was Ishmael? And it's clearly shown that it's supposed to be Isaac. So that's all good and well. But then Isaac has a wife. And the question is, how is this promise about the descendants and about especially the messianic descendant, the eventual Christ, how's that going to come through Isaac? And Isaac has a wife, Rebecca, has a similar problem as Abraham and Sarah. His wife is barren, but he prays to God. He doesn't come up with, the same solution that his mother and father tried. He prays to God, which is an improvement, right? There's some progress here. And God opens Rebecca's womb, so much so that she has two children. She has twins. So now you have a new issue, right, Jonathan? You have the question, well, okay, before we only had one son, and so it was clear it's going to be Isaac. Now there's two sons. They're being born at the same time. They're struggling together in the womb. Which of these two boys is going to be the son of promise, if you will? Does that make sense?
Yep. And so the question now is not, we don't have kids. The question is, we have not too many kids, but we don't know which is which. And then you have this ancient, and it's still kind of here. I don't know if it's natural law or not. It certainly does impact the family. Birth order matters. Oldest child's not that they should inherit everything, but they tend to be oldest childs and youngest childs. So, yeah. So in the ancient world, that meant that you were the leader, and the leader is Esau. But then you got this issue with before they're born, Rebecca's, I don't know, struggling with them in her womb. That's an interesting tidbit.
Right. That's the whole question is, how do we figure out which of these children, which of my sons is the promised son? Do I figure it out based on, like, is it just up to me? You know, put yourself in Isaac's shoes. Do I get, okay, I have a couple of sons here. Do I just get to pick whichever one I like more? Do I go by whichever one was born first? Or is there some, is God going to determine for me which one is the promised son? And that's what, you know, that's ultimately the answer. But what you don't want to flatten out the story, because then you lose a little bit of the actual, the way this plays out is fascinating, isn't it? I mean, Isaac keeps trying to bless Esau, and you're going to get to this in two chapters. I don't know who's going to do that for you, but that's really, I think, the big story of Jacob and Esau. That's the one most of us are going to know. But even what we're going to cover today kind of prefigures that or foreshadows that later, fuller struggle between Jacob and Esau and Isaac, really, of which of my sons is the blessed son, is the chosen son.
I think this is my favorite of these two texts particularly, but of within Jacob's life. I like him and Esau and the issue that happens at the Jabbok Ford much, much later. But this point to me is so poignant in terms of the threat. Is it because it's the law? Is that why I like it? It is the threat, the revelation that it has for who we are and what our tendencies are with regard to the promises of God. So I want to get to that in a moment, but I still want to stick with a little bit here. What do you make of Rebecca's prayer, her struggling, and of God's speaking at that point, and then also the naming of the kids, and does this relate at all to what Rebecca knows? Does only Rebecca know this? Does Isaac know this as well? That kind of stuff.
Right. That's a question that I really go back and forth on in my mind. So let me put it to you this way. The question is this, the main emphasis in Genesis is these are not just disconnected kind of random stories. The thread that's running through the whole thing is who is the son of promise, right? Who is going to be the one through whom God's blessing is going to come into the whole world? And so Rebecca is struggling with that. Rebecca has these two sons in her womb, and they seem to be at war within her already as babies. And so she's not just saying, like, man, I have a really hard pregnancy. I'm sure that was part of it. But Rebecca and Isaac are both, you know, Christians before Christ. And so their minds are geared towards this question, which of these two boys is going to be the, you know, the promised son? And I really don't, I don't know how she inquires of the Lord, how the Lord appears to her and answers her question, but he does, right? This is like Hebrews 1, in many and various ways, God spoke to his people of old. God tells her, it's going to be the younger, right? The elder shall serve the younger. So very clearly, it's the younger one who's going to be the promised son. But then something strange is that we're never told that she tells Isaac this.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I wish there was a verse right after that. And Rebecca went and told Isaac, and they gave thanks to the Lord. But there's no mention of that, right? And so you're kind of left with this question. Okay, Rebecca knows. Does Isaac know? And that gets further amplified because you get this description of Isaac loved Esau and Rebecca loved Jacob. And so you kind of have favorites, right? You have dad loves Esau. And we might speculate as to why. It kind of explains a little bit. Rebecca loved Jacob, doesn't even say why. She just did. And that comes back then later with the blessing. Isaac really does want to bless Esau, but Jacob, Rebecca has this plan in which Jacob kind of steals the blessing. Although we knew from the beginning that was going to be God's choice. So it's a fascinating interplay of like God's choosing and the way that that people try to work that choosing out.
Yeah, it's fascinating on so many levels. Rebecca is like this model wife, right? And Isaac, this model husband. We did a bit a couple days ago with their marriage, showing how well their marriage worked out, the roles they both are willing to play. They're kind of a, so far as the Old Testament is concerned, they're a great couple, right? There's not a lot of weird stuff going. You're not, you know, concubines getting brought in and all this kind of stuff, right? And yet, then here she is deceiving him in his old age. I mean, oof, yikes, that's a bit rough. And within that, then, the issue of stealing the birthright is what's going to happen then, but the question is it after what happens today? Or is the birthright actually given away? So we'll save that until we get there. One more question before we get into text, and that is just generally about election and God's purposes of election. Every time I teach this, I make it a can of worms somehow, and we can never get away from it. So I'm not even going to introduce it. I'm just going to let you try and give us a general idea of what that doctrine is, why it's important, and how it's going to kind of interplay today.
The doctrine of election has to do with who is saved, who ultimately are those who are saved, and why. That's really the question. Why are some saved and others aren't? And finally, the doctrine of election is a doctrine of grace, right? Those who are saved by grace. God chooses them freely of his own will. He chooses those who he will save, not because he has to, right? None of us deserve, God doesn't owe us anything. We don't deserve to be saved. No one does. And so the mystery is that anyone would be saved. And this comes up in the book of Romans. Actually, Paul will mention Jacob and Esau. That's the one place in the New Testament that keys in on this part of the Genesis account. And the point of the doctrine of election is to comfort us and say, it is by grace through and through. It is by grace. God chose us before the foundation of the world. In love, he predestined us for salvation. Okay? And then the flip side of that is that people want to say, well, does that mean then he also chose those who are not saved? And that's where we kind of throw up our hands and say, we don't say that, because we don't have that in the Bible. We only have the fact that God chooses those who are saved.
And if you do say that, even though the Bible doesn't say it, and you say that reason tells you have to say that, which some do, you end up in some pretty dark places with regards to the identity of God and the source of evil in the world, because reason must take you to those as well. And God actually likes damning people. It's just something he wants to do. It's his kind of pastime. Yeah. And it's not their fault. He just does it. That's awful. It's really awful.
And there's so many things. Yeah, we could do the whole show on election, but for our purposes today, when it comes to what we're going to key on, we'll key in on this and we can maybe apply it later to individuals. But the key thing here is, which son is chosen and why? You know, why does God choose Jacob and not Esau? You know, why doesn't God choose Esau? Well, because he didn't, you know, and he doesn't reveal, oh, it was because Jacob was smarter or Jacob was nicer or Esau was a particularly heinous person. That doesn't factor in at all. It's simply God chose to do it this way. And he did, that's an act of his grace. I want to emphasize that, because it's not just a random occurrence, right? When God chooses something, he's not doing it because he has to, right? So he's not bound by some kind of law outside of himself that says, God, you must do it this way. But his grace, his desire to save the world, is what motivates his choosing of Jacob.
I think that's helpful. And again, we could go forever on just this topic, because it's got a lot of wormholes. So verse 25, Genesis chapter 25, the first came out, the first boy, he's born all red, his body like a hairy cloak. So they called his name Red Guy, Esau. Afterward, verse 26, his brother came out with his hand holding Esau's heel, right? He's got his hand grabbed around him. I try to imagine a baby's hand doing this, because they're not like the most dexterous little things, right? But he's got it grabbed on. So his name was called Jacob, which again, I think literally is grabber of the heel, but becomes colloquialish for trickster, deceiver, one who trips, that kind of thing. Isaac was 60 years old when she bore them. Verse 27, when the boys grew up, Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field, while Jacob was a quiet man dwelling in tents. We did look at some of these verses yesterday, and we talked a little bit about this, and I kind of made the case you got a jock and maybe a scholar. It's not that Jacob is effeminate, but he certainly is not what you call outdoorsy, right? Which is I'll raise my hand and throw myself in that boat, even though I think I might be a jock, but I'm definitely not outdoorsy. Either way, what's clear is there's a real difference in these guys' personalities. They are night and day kind of thing, right? So Jacob stays in the tents and is active doing something. Basket weaving, probably not. Something of value. Someone said chef yesterday. Yeah, maybe, except Esau's the guy that cooks the food later. Jacob does it too, doesn't he? Verse 28, Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his game, right? So he likes the meat and where the meat comes from. Rebekah loved Jacob. We don't know why. She just does. Maybe it's the promises. Again, there's a lot there. I think we could mine this for an hour just by itself. The names are always fascinating to me. I love how Old Testament names, I wish we did translate them. I wish we didn't, I forget what the word is, just bring the sounds into English because we lose something there. I'm convinced that all the names are supposed to mean what they say. So what are your thoughts there and what we can learn from that?
Yeah, I think I would emphasize two things of what you said there, Jonathan. One, when they're born, they're connected. That's the point of Jacob grabbing the heel, right? So they're coming out, and there's not even really a clear distinction between one baby and the next. I mean, there is, right? It's not like, oh, they're not conjoined twins or something like that, but they are connected. And so even at the birth, right, it's like what was happening in the womb is still going on, right? And that's going to continue in their life, right? They're connected, and which one is the child of, I don't know if we want to put it this way, but which one is the child of destiny, right? Well, which one is the firstborn? I don't know, they kind of came out together, you know? And so you could say, well, yeah, obviously Esau's firstborn, and he is, it says, he came out first. But the whole point is Jacob and Esau are connected, and which one is going to be, again, I keep saying this to drive home the point, which one is the son of promise? As far as the names go, it's kind of interesting, the name Esau, Edom, is actually closer. Later, he's going to be called Edom, and his descendants are called the Edomites. Edom is actually closer to the Hebrew word for red. I was looking through various commentaries because my Hebrew is not so strong. But Esau itself is a step removed from red. You know what I mean? But it's still, you're right, it does mean red guy, and that's the explanation. Whether he had red hair or red skin, the point is he's red. And then Jacob, the meaning of the name Jacob, the Hebrew word for heel is Yekeb, and then that gets to Yaakov, which gives you Jacob, right? And so you just take the word heel and you turn it into a name, and so he's the heel grabber, which could mean, you know, he's the grabber, he's the deceiver. Esau's going to say later, he's the supplanter, right? He's tricked me these two times. And so that he gives it this very negative connotation that Jacob is a trickster or a deceiver. And I think we've sort of latched on to that in many ways, but I think it's useful to note that is Esau's negative evaluation of his brother. And you can see why Esau would say that about his brother, right? Because he wanted the blessing, although he had already sold it away. And there's nothing in Jacob, I just want to point this out, there's nothing in him, like, at the beginning that says he's a deceiver.
All right, yeah, not as a baby, maybe. I don't know. I love, because of the interplay between the word Jacob and the word Israel, right, and where he gets put by the end of the story, I like to think that he's not the most honest chap you ever found. At the very least, he's wily, right? And so, I mean, when he gives him the porridge, it's like, hey, brother, do this. I mean, he knows what's going on. He knows what he's doing. And honest?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, I don't know.
He's,
what do you think?
All I'm saying, Jonathan, is it's not a like from the beginning. It's not like Rebecca named him a bad name. Like you're going to be a deceiver. you grabbed your brother's heel, and then later Esau says, "Yeah," and that was a sign of how you know you were always trying to grab things from me. Esau. Okay, look, you sold your birthright. You didn't care about it, and we're going to read in a minute. You despised the birthright, and Jacob. Jacob loved the birthright. You know, Jacob wanted it. He desired it. And Esau wanted to get rid of it. He thought it was of no value to him.
And that's going to be the meat of what we talk about this morning, although I think we maybe should save that for the other side of the break, just so we have time and don't get cut off. And we've only got a couple minutes here on this side. So anything else from this front end before we get into verse 29? What else is in verses 24 to 28 that you find valuable?
Yeah, I think the love of the parents is an important thing to bring out. You'll remember when God commands Abraham to offer up Isaac, he specifies, take your son, your beloved son, Isaac, and sacrifice him, right? And if God had said that to Isaac, which son would he have taken? His beloved son is Esau. And we're told why. It's because maybe Isaac was a hunter. I don't remember that ever coming up before, but something about Esau, Isaac just loves Esau, okay? He loves him because of his interest in hunting and game. And so this is what I was getting at kind of early on in our conversation. Does Isaac get to choose which son he passes on the blessing to, or has it already been determined by God? The answer is it's already been determined, but Isaac's love here is set against not set against, but it's brought up to show the difference between God's choosing and man's choosing, right? Isaac loves the firstborn. Maybe that's part of why he loves Esau, and he loves the one who does something that pleases him. But God has already chosen Jacob for no reason other than his gracious election.
With just about a minute, which maybe isn't quite fair, how important do you think, this is totally off the wall, and there's not a right answer. How important do you think is being the firstborn in natural law? It's off the wall, I know.
Yeah, it's going to come up in when God gives the law through Moses. There actually is there's a command in Deuteronomy 21, I think, I was looking this up, that the firstborn son gets twice as much as everybody else. So if you have two brothers, the firstborn gets two-thirds, and the secondborn just gets one-third, right? Now, we're in a time pre-Mosaic law, and so there's not a, we don't have a command from God, but you did have all of these other stories about the inheritance, and what did Abraham always do? He always gave the entire thing to the chosen son. And with Isaac, there never were other sons of Abraham and Sarah, right? So you never had to figure out, well, which one gets the inheritance, because it was always Isaac. And then he had, like, what, stepbrothers? And you always had, the stepbrothers can have gifts, but they're always sent away. And the lump sum inheritance is exclusively belongs to the son of promise.
And that's amazing. And it's amazing that to answer the question of firstborn built into creation itself, you have to talk about sons and daughters being different as well, which Americans aren't really very comfortable with that one either these days. So we don't have time to dig quite into it as much as I really would like to. Sharp Ryan, we'll come back and deal with selling your salvation for some stew, some porridge. Not a good idea, but it happened. Stick around.
Thousands of years ago, a story began.
I am.
The story that will never end, because this is the story of God's love for us.
He has risen!
He is alive!
Welcome to the Lamplighter Classic Audio Series. You are there. Now, you can enjoy this Lamplighter Classic, You Are There, together as a family.
Saturday mornings at 11 on Worldwide KFUO.
Worldwide KFUO Radio salutes our day sponsors on this Thursday, May 16th, 2019. Today's Day sponsors are John and Carmen Mettler. Today's Day sponsors have made a contribution to Worldwide KFUO Radio, given by John in honor of his wife, Carmen, as they celebrate their 22nd wedding anniversary. Once again, we say thank you to John and Carmen Mettler of Raleigh, North Carolina, today's Worldwide KFUO Day sponsors.
Child of God Lutheran Church and School is fully accredited pre-K through 8th grade, offering a high-quality Christian education. Recognized by Google as a 2019 top-rated private school, our student-to-teacher ratio ensures the relational education that kids need and parents desire. Conveniently located on Salt Lick Road in St. Peters, Missouri, just a short drive from Interstate 70. Interested in enrolling? Visit our website at coglcs.com or call 636-970-7080.
Hola! These are the voices of young Lutherans in Mexico City, children who are excited to learn more about their Savior, Jesus. But they need our help because good Lutheran books for kids in the Spanish language are in short supply in Mexico. To learn how you can help tell Spanish-speaking kids everywhere about Jesus in a language they can understand, go to the Lutheran Heritage Foundation website at lhfmissions.org/Juan316.
Lots of good chatter on Facebook about the motivations of Jacob and Esau, why they did what they did, who they were after, what they believed in, and especially how in the womb this fight was already going on. One thing that wasn't mentioned there is the possibility that Jacob had actually been positioned to be the firstborn, and then that's what the fight was about, was Esau trying to get out of the womb as an infant without knowing what he was doing. But somehow there's bigger things going on behind all of this, trying to deal with Genesis chapter 25 this morning here on Sharper Iron with Pastor David Appled. He is pastor at St. Paul Lutheran Church in Paducah, Kentucky. We're looking at now verse 29 and following through the end of the chapter, where it jumps ahead from the birth of Jacob and Esau, red guy and deceiver. I still like to call him that. Although I didn't mention this, Pastor Apple, you made me think we do have words for this. Sometimes if you call a guy a heel today, like it literally means that you're kind of a jerk, right? And so yeah, Jacob literally means heel. So we got heel, and then we got ginger over here, right? Ginger man, right? so in any case, the names are more than just sounds. They're nickname names of real substance that carry a meaning that's given to them. They grow up. They're different. Esau likes to hunt. Jacob likes to do stuff in the tents. One time, verse 29, once when Jacob was cooking stew, Esau came in from the field and he was exhausted. Right, so he'd been out, sitting in a tree, waiting for the deer to come by, that kind of thing. And yeah, he's ready for some food. And Esau said to Jacob, "Let me eat some of that red stew, for I am exhausted." Therefore, his name was called Edom. So now we're going from, you mentioned that the red of Esau is a little different than the red of Edom. And yet they're both red. So I don't know enough Hebrew to get the difference. Is this like crimson versus fuchsia or what?
No, it's more the Edom is actually closer to the Hebrew word that just means red. It comes from like Dom. Adam is the man of the dirt, right? But it's like red clay. Right.
Okay.
So if you just sound out the Hebrew, Edom is closer to the actual word for red than Esau. Esau is a little bit derivative of red, but
still means
that's
red.
Really important.
Somehow.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's fascinating though because the names are always shifting, and because Hebrew is such a it's a language in which the most important thing is spelling. Which is weird, I think. In as an English major, studier of languages, spelling matters, but not as much as it does in Hebrew. In Hebrew, really, it matters a great deal. So I think it's fascinating, and why. So what was the distinction of the meaning of this lesser red or different red from earlier? But with that said, now because the stew is like a real red, then his later name, his nickname, becomes that word Edom, and Edom is where the Edomites come from. So in the history of Israel, for your Bible, as you're reading it, this is fairly important. You're not going to have the Esauites. And so you might just forget that Esau was there. But every time you have the Edomites, you have a very different you have the Esau lineage there. And just think about it this way. If I'm not mistaken, by the time you get down to Herod the Great, this guy who's ruling over Judea, right? That guy's an Edomite. right? So he's not really in the line, yeah, but he almost is, and he kind of wants to be in charge, yeah? So this doesn't go away between them. When Israel and Judah split, the Edomites are actually part of that as well. So this is kind of it's a big deal to not lose who Edom is. In any case, Jacob says, verse 31, sell me your birthright now, right? So you want my food? All right, here it is. One price, one time, handshake, let's do it. And Esau says, he sounds like a teenager. I'm about to die. Of what use is a birthright to me, right? I'm starving, Mom. Give me food. But this is just it. Of what use is a birthright to him? It shows how little he believes that if you die with this birthright, you're going to rise from the dead, because the birthright for you, chosen one, is that you can never die until you've passed forward at least this lineage to somebody else. So he doesn't believe it. Jacob said, swear to me now. So he's like, serious, right? No, I'm not kidding. Here you go. You want the food? Swear. So he swore. What? Yes, he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau bread and lentil stew. Lentils. And he ate and drank and rose and went his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright. Now, there was no cutting of a covenant. There was no witnesses that were told of here. So how much of this was Esau even considering real? And yet in the eyes of God, well, it was. One other question. You got a lot of things I know you can say. One other question here is, you know, and I hate to open this can of worms again, but is this something God foreknew, and therefore the reason why God makes the electing choice later? The idea of foreknowledge kind of needs to be addressed.
I think, we can take that question first. Yes, God knew this would happen. Nothing happens outside of God's knowing, right? He knows all things. God is never surprised, like, I didn't know David was going to say that to Jonathan this morning. He knows all things. But whether or not that is the reason why he chooses Jacob, that's where I would say, no, we don't make that. That's a leap that we don't make, right? So when Rebecca asked God, it doesn't say God looked into the future, and since he knew that Jacob would want the birthright and Esau wouldn't, then God said, well, I'm going to choose Jacob. The younger, or the elder shall serve the younger. It works the other way around, right? Because of God's choosing of Jacob, then in time, you know, how this worked out in time, we're not really told. Like, did Isaac tell the boys when they were kids, like, hey guys, just so you know, I would imagine that Isaac actually taught his sons about the promises of God, don't you think?
And I would hope so.
I would think that the birthright would have been a big deal. That's why, and I think, Jonathan, that's why Jacob, look at how quick Jacob is to say, tell me your birthright now. Like, it's as if his whole life he's been wanting the birthright. And now Esau is like the opposite. His whole life he's been, yeah, whatever. It's of no real use to me. You can have it, Jacob. And Jacob's like not even content with that. He wants it sure and certain. Swear it, right? Swear it in an oath so that you can't go back later and say, well, I was hungry. You know, like this, we want an official transaction. So Jacob's desire for the birthright is actually, here's maybe how to say it. This is the playing out of God's choosing, is that Esau doesn't care about the birthright and Jacob loves the birthright.
A key piece in this idea of election in view of foreknowledge is what it does is it makes the word of God an effect of us as cause. So you're immediately putting yourselves into justification by works. That's a fast leap, but that's what happens. And the fact of the scriptures is the word of God is never an effect. It's never something we do or make or cause. It is the cause. And so the cause of the word of promise being given, then being put into the ears of Jacob, is why he wants the birthright. And it is Esau's rejection of that by his own sinful will that is the his own doing, right? God didn't cause that. He caused that.
Yeah, I think that's a helpful thing to point out. Like, Jacob and Esau are not neutral. Neither of them are neutral characters, right? Every person, every descendant of Adam who's born by natural descent, we have to say that because, you know, Jesus
is
born,
special,
but, you know, without sin. Every son or daughter who's born of natural descent is born as a sinner, and that includes Jacob. However, from that same lump, of humanity, God does choose to save some, right? He chooses those who he will save. And his choosing is effective. I like the way that you said that. It's not because he looked into the future, but his choosing causes Jacob then in time to believe through, you know, whatever Isaac had taught them. Maybe Rebecca had taught them something too. And that worked faith in Jacob. And so he wanted the birthright. He actually wanted it, and Esau didn't.
Let's come back to that in a moment and tangent here into one of your points about public oaths and how the fact that it isn't just, yeah, sure, brother, whatever, but that he does willingly take a full swearing, that this is a display of what you really value, what he really valued as a person, yeah, whether he was hungry or not.
You want to come back to that later, or you want to?
No, I want to hit that now and then come back to what his, sure. Well, I want to talk about public oaths, right? So it's in bold. You put it in bold. Just do public oaths and then come back to what does it say about him as a person. Let's talk about vows as they're, what they reveal about us.
Yeah, that's good. That's a good way to put it, right? So Jacob could have, he didn't need to press Esau for an oath, right? He could have just said, okay, you promised. That's good enough, right? But why does he make Esau take an oath? Because of the seriousness of what's being transacted, right? So the birthright is not just like, well, Dad's going to give me a family heirloom, you know. This is the promised inheritance that God had promised Abraham, right? And so Jacob is not content to simply let that be something that Esau kind of passes on, you know, gives to him or agrees to give to him. Just sort of randomly one day. This is of utmost seriousness, not only for the brothers, but this is going to be serious for the rest of the world, right? And to kind of translate that into our times, think about the things that we actually are willing to take oaths about or to make vows about. Jesus says, let your yes be yes and let your no be no. You have the commandment, you shall not give false testimony against your neighbor. But we recognize that there are times when it is important to take an oath, right? Maybe you're called in to give testimony in court, and you do have to actually take an oath. And you're right to do that. But we could also think of the other times and occurrences in a person's life where vows or oaths are sworn. And I think marriage is one that comes to mind for not just for Christians, but for everyone. This is a very serious thing that we aren't just saying, yeah, this is a relationship between me and this woman, and, you know, it's just between us. No, this is a public thing, and it's so serious that I'm going to actually make a vow. Does that make sense?
It does. I want to emphasize, so the reason for this seriousness in marriage is because there's going to be other humans involved. Right. So not just the extended family, but like what you're about to do with this woman is going to make more people. So we want to make sure you two are like on this thing. Right. Like this is for real. Yeah. And we're going to hold you accountable for that. You don't get to just do this and then walk away. Now, our culture doesn't do that anymore. Right. And even our churches are weak in the way we do that. Yeah. But the vow is there because of that and for that reason. Yeah. And what you're saying then in the bigger picture here is that any time that you have a public vow being taken in a society, it is demonstrating what the society, in theory, believes to be valuable. The fact that you're willing to do it, to be under oath, means you're really putting your name on this thing. So the cavalier way in which Esau does this says something about his character to begin with, that he will cavalierly take an oath, which brings us to even like Jesus' words about do not swear at all, right? So if you're just like, oh, I swear, well, it's like you don't really believe in much, do you?
Yeah.
Because you're willing to swear anything. So that's kind of the idea, right?
Right. And think about some of the ways people will talk about marriage, like the instant, like, I mean, people say this to me from time to time, right? Well, marriage, it's just a slip of paper, right? It's just a legal thing. Like, that's the whole point, is that you are making this promise to this other person, this man or this woman. You're making this promise, and you're willing to put your name on the line, right? You're willing to say this is not just like something we agreed to in the heat of the moment. This isn't something that we just thought of this weekend. but like we are committing ourselves legally to one another. That's more than just the promise. And I think that's what some people don't, they think that somehow that's unromantic, right? Well, what's really romantic or what's really passionate is the promise that we made to each other. But if that's true, if you've made this great promise to each other, why wouldn't you put your name on the line? You know what I mean? And that's what's, it's a step removed from what's going on with Jacob and Esau, but I bring it up here because Jacob is completely serious about this birthright, so much so he wants Esau to swear an oath. And Esau is like the guy who says, yeah, whatever, you know, it doesn't matter, because he doesn't care about the birthright, but Jacob loves it.
There's something that keeps coming back in my head. I don't know if it really connects here immediately. I can't stop thinking about all the other sons of Abraham being sent away from the camp. And if Jacob, having just seen that, doesn't have that in the back of his head at some point. And this ultimately is about being outside the faith. Although we're not saying that those sons were outside the faith, it is a picture of what it is to be outside the faith. So to not want it is a good thing. And so he's sitting there, and how much of that brings about his seriousness, whereas Esau just assumes everything's fine, I'm taken care of, not a problem, and how much that plays into this. It then, I think because of that also, directly connects to the threat this brings to us as Christians, right? We are Esau. We're born with promises in baptism, right? We are the firstborn. At this moment in the story, we have the promise. We don't have to sell it, but we can. And the threat of the pot of porridge and what is the value of the thing? When I don't go to church, or when I don't believe in this piece of the Word of God, or when I prefer, when I ignore something, you know, I'll confess my own, you know, specifically. As much as I know it's wrong, man, I like money. Yeah, I'd like a little more, that kind of thing. And that's a threat to the faith, right? That's porridge. And to bring that forward and to see that threat, I think is very solemn and needs to be taken from this text. What do you think?
Yeah, I think you're channeling the author of Hebrews, because that's how in Hebrews, that's how Esau is brought up. Esau is brought up as a warning for Christians. Let no one be, what does it say? It's in Hebrews chapter 12. Let no one be unholy, or I think they say an adulterer or a fornicator. That's the King James, like Esau was. And the idea is, do not be so controlled by your passions, you know, the immediate gratification of a thing, that you give up the, you know, what is actually important. You know, because Esau here is described as despising the birthright. Well, how did he despise it? Did he really hate it? You know, that despising language is feels very emotional. Like, I hate the birthright. It's not that he hated it, but he valued something more highly than it. And what did he value? He just valued the filling of his belly more highly than the birthright, which, when you put it in those stark terms, like, how could he do that? You know, yeah. Don't you know what the promise is about connected to this birthright? But in the moment, he said, it's not of any value to me right now. So I'm going to sacrifice the future for the present. I'll put it that way. And that's what the author of Hebrews comes up with and says, look, this, don't be like Esau. Don't do this. Don't be so controlled by your present gratifications of your passions that you lose what is eternal. And, you know, this is very valuable for us, especially in materialistic kind of, we like instant gratification, and we are very much controlled by our passions. I want the best life I can have right now. And if that means, you know, putting off God's things, well, you know, he'll forgive me, surely, right? I can come back to him later. You know, when I'm 40, I can come back to God. Well, that's playing with grace, right? That's trifling with grace. And that this is part of the challenge, especially for younger people, is to see what really matters in life. What is eternal? What is the stuff that I never want to lose? And what is fleeting? What is temporary?
He gave me like three different thoughts there at the end, so they're all fighting with each other in my head. and I think I lost all of them. The future being sacrificed for the present is maybe the most important thing there.
I think so.
It is so easy to lose sight of where we are. And this goes for temporal things. This goes for first article stuff. But then it goes absolutely for what it means to be the church. The movement of American Christianity to try to appease the culture in both its liberal progressive and church growth forms is one of saying now matters more than the future and not believing the future will be here for us based on the Word of God alone. It is giving up. I remember watching a video of a church that it was a Lutheran church that had rebuilt itself into something else. And so as a result, they had church there, but then they only did it, you know, sometimes the rest of the time it was a different use for the facility. And I remember watching them in the service, in the middle of the service, roll in a little table to serve as the altar and then roll it away afterwards. And I couldn't help but just see a symbolic thing in that, right? That you're saying this thing is not the center anymore. Whether they meant to do it or not doesn't matter. It's endemic to who we are as American Christians and as American Lutherans. So I think that's just a huge point to dwell on. And what are we willing to give up now so that we can convince ourselves things are okay, rather than trust that the promise is it's okay because we got Jesus. He's enough. With that said, you have one other point I want to give you a chance to get to. You can follow up on that one as well. We got about 5 minutes here, but the point about, and I got to bounce around my computer, the point about, you know, maybe this is connected. What does Jacob's inheritance have to do with Christ and the church? How does this ultimately hit us today in real ways?
Yeah, so we've been sort of circling around like firstborn status, and that's all connected in here because the inheritance is what ought to go to the firstborn, and Esau is content to give that away. In some ways, he seems almost eager to give it away. It's of no value to him. Jacob loves it and greatly desires it, and he gets it here with an oath. What does that have to do with us? Well, when you play it, when you bring this in through to the New Testament, there's going to be the question of who is the ultimate descendant of Abraham, right? Who is the final firstborn son? I guess we could put it that way. And this is where you get a couple descriptions of Jesus that are titles given to him by in the epistles. He's called the firstborn of all creation. That's a status claim, and he's called the firstborn from the dead, right? Which is also this, I want to connect that to the status of the firstborn. So he is the heir of all things, right? All things belong to him. All authority in heaven and earth has been given to me, Jesus says. He is the heir of it all. Does that mean that we don't receive anything? Well, you also get these marvelous descriptions of Christians being co-heirs with Jesus, right? So by faith, we are joined to him, and we receive the inheritance along with him, which is what's so marvelous about the whole thing, right? With Jacob, it had to be exclusive, and it's almost sad when you get to Genesis 27, Esau is begging his father, Isaac, like after the fact, my father, don't you have a blessing for me too? And Isaac says, no, I gave it all to your brother. And that had to be the way that it was in the earthly, you know, in the prefigurement of the thing. But what's so wonderful is in the inheritance of Christ, we are co-heirs with him, and the blessing abounds to many sons, right? So there are so many passages, but the one that might be easiest is Galatians 3:29. Then we are co-heirs with him. Sons of Abraham by faith, and we receive that inheritance along with Christ.
I was thinking as you were starting in there, you know, with the who is the son of Abraham and how Jacob is the son of Abraham because of his, whether it's wily or not, his faith in the promise and his desire for it.
Yeah.
And Esau is not his son, although he is his son by blood in his despising of the promise, he is not. And so that's pretty key. With about a minute left, put a bow on it. Anything we haven't talked about? Anything you want to say again?
I would emphasize again, the God's choosing of Jacob is by grace, and the gift that is given to him is always by grace. So this is how Paul talks about it in Romans 9. It's not according to him who runs or him who works, but according to God who calls. Like, in behind all of this, the iceberg underneath the water is God's plan of salvation, and he's going to bring through the turmoil of this family and the strange relationship of these brothers, God is at work to bring his Christ into the world. And that comes in the fullness of time. And in the fullness of time, God sends his son to redeem those who are under the law.
Pastor David Appold is pastor at St. Paul Lutheran Church in Paducah, Kentucky, helping us out this morning here on Sharper Iron with Genesis chapter 25, verses 25 through 34. A little bit of the text overlapping from yesterday, because it's chock full of stuff, as you heard. The key in all of this being, first, the lineage of Jesus is not our doing, but God's doing, that he's working this, and that these promises that are given through us in history end up being about him, and that he fulfills all these things, and all these characters down that line, sometimes they're in, sometimes they're out, sometimes they're a little bit of both back and forth. They're there for us to learn about the value of these promises, the confidence, the sustainability of these promises, that they will never fail us, they will never leave us, so that you have the promises that just like Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, they know they can't die. Even though they die, yet they will live. And this allows you to look at the passions of this present age, the passions of your life, the porridge of what is, and say, I may be starving, but I'm not so starving that I'm not going to rise from the dead on the last day when Jesus Christ comes back with trumpet sound and glory and all, right? And so standing firm in what you believe and why you believe it, because the scripture says it, these stories lift you up to know that Christ is sufficient for all things. Christ is coming back, my friends. It'll be sooner than later, one way or the other. You're going to see it happen. Dead or alive, you're going to rise and live with me in eternity. I'm your host, Pastor Jonathan Fisk, and I look forward to waking up with you at that dawn.